What I Have Learned, the third talk at Gutenberg College's 2014 Summer Institute and 20th Anniversary Celebration, was presented by Ron Julian on August 1, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My task is to talk about what I have learned as a Gutenberg tutor. I guess I need to warn you right up front that the only way I could find to talk about this was to talk personally about my own journey, so darn, I hate to do it, but I'm going to have to talk about myself. What have I learned at Gutenberg? There are certainly many things that I could talk about. Today I know a lot more about Euclid and the nature of mathematics than I did 20 years ago. I have read and reread a number of very significant books on philosophy and history and theology. I've learned that my favorite novel is Anna Karenina. I have had a chance to broaden my knowledge in the arts, and certainly in another talk, on another occasion, these would all be very worthwhile things to talk about. But today I want to talk about the central preoccupation of my adult life. Since the time I became a Christian at the age of 18, I have struggled to understand the Bible and its fundamental message. What does it mean to be a Christian? What does genuine spirituality look like? And how can I know that I have understood what the Bible says about these things? The attempt to answer these questions has set the course of my life. And so today, I want to talk to you about how teaching at Gutenberg has contributed to my thinking about these questions. To be honest, teaching at Gutenberg ended up throwing me for a loop. I did not set out to be a college teacher, and before I started teaching at Gutenberg, I thought I had things pretty much together. So, in order to talk about the impact of Gutenberg on my thinking, I need to start by talking about the time before that, how I came to think about the faith in the years before I started teaching at Gutenberg. Many of you know this story. My early years as a Christian were marked by confusion and unhappiness. I had become committed to the idea that the God of the Bible was real and that I needed to do business with him. This happened at the age of 18. I was a dedicated atheist before that time. So it was a genuine conversion, a genuine change of mind. But I did not understand the Bible and I did not understand God. I found modern Christian culture unattractive. I still do. And I was deeply confused about what exactly it meant to be a Christian. And it seemed to me that the people around me were confused about that as well. In particular, I became very aware of my own moral failings, and I struggled to understand what the Bible had to say to a person like me. It was out of these very painful struggles that my desire to understand the Bible grew, and they are ultimately what led me to being a teacher. So, to keep this simple, I want to talk about two verses from the Bible. These are verses that I struggled to understand, and when I finally felt that I did understand them, they greatly affected how I understood the faith. You understand that I'm simplifying this. I did more than look at two verses, but I'm just sort of using them to capture a significant part of what I was wrestling with. First verse was 2 Corinthians 3:5. Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who also made us adequate as servants of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Now, this may seem a strange verse to pick, but this was a very important verse in the church community that I was a part of. I was taught that Paul, in this verse, was promising every Christian a supernatural empowering. We should stop trying to be good on our own power. We were not adequate to do it. Instead, we should let go and let God. We should plug in to the power of the Holy Spirit and let God work through us. By plugging into the power of the Spirit, God makes us adequate to do anything. Thus, every Christian could have complete victory over sin by plugging into the power of God. This was victorious Christian life theology, or there's a whole variety of terms that it's referred to, Keswick theology and so on. Well, because this issue of my own personal struggle with sin was so central in my experience, this was a confusing and difficult theology to sort through, and I suffered greatly under it for several years. At one point, however, I actually started to read this verse in the context of 2 Corinthians. I discovered that Paul was not promising supernatural victory to every Christian. In context, it seemed clear to me that Paul was talking about himself. He was talking about how God had supernaturally empowered Paul to be an apostle of Christ. This was one of the major turning points in my life, as strange as it might seem. First of all, it began the process by which I came to reject victorious Christian life theology because I started to see that the Bible wasn't teaching it, that the passages that were used to enforce this way of thinking, as I looked at them, it became clear that that's not what they were talking about. But even more importantly, this event opened my eyes to the importance of reading in context. That is, we shouldn't pull verses out of the Bible and use them to answer our own questions. We should look carefully at the flow of thought, seeking to discover what the author wanted to talk about. I saw that, unfortunately, the church was very bad at teaching people to do this. In fact, when I tried to explain to people what I was seeing in the contextual analysis of Paul's argument in 2 Corinthians, it was rejected. They thought it was weird. The Bible is supposed to be talking to us personally. Why would I be interested in Paul saying something about himself? It needs to be about me. So I saw right away that there was a choice. It was like a fork in the road, and I had to decide, was I going to try to read the Bible on its own terms, or was I going to come to it demanding that it answer my questions? So this was a huge deal to me. It became very clear to me the power of reading the Bible in that way, and yet that it was a real choice, and that unfortunately the church wasn't very good at doing it. This is really how we ought to understand any verbal communication. How do I understand what somebody has written or what somebody says? I do it by paying careful attention to the words they use and the context and the flow of their thought. So, in order to read the Bible with integrity, it seems to me, we have to make this decision that we are going to humbly let the author speak for himself. This was one of the most important decisions I ever made, and I have been committed to that way of reading the Bible ever since. And I should say that Jack Crabtree was instrumental in helping me to think about this and develop my skills at that time. So this passage had this profound effect on me in two ways. It began a change in my theological thinking, where I came to recognize that the theology that I had been taught wasn't really supported by a careful reading of the Bible, and it convinced me that we need to read the Bible carefully in context, searching for the flow of thought that will show what the author intended. The other passage that will illustrate the development of my thinking at this time is James 2:24. You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Now remember, at this time I was deeply aware of my own moral failings. I was deeply troubled by the question of where a sinner like me stood with God. I had a very much a Martin Luther sort of experience where I just didn't know where I stood given what I saw in my own life. One of my all-time favorite verses was from Romans. We are justified by faith and not by works of the law. That sounded very hopeful and accepting. And here was James seemingly contradicting what Paul was saying, we are justified by works and not by faith alone. I hated that verse. I cannot tell you how much I hated that verse. But this verse had several bad effects on me at this time. First of all, it led me to question whether the Bible knew what it was talking about at all. Most Christians that I knew claimed that the Bible was without errors, and yet it seemed clear to me that James was directly contradicting Paul. They can't both be right, I thought, and I became very cynical about the Bible for a while. I never abandoned my belief in God, but I can remember very clearly going around and very condescendingly informing other Christians how naive they were to think that the Bible was inerrant, because look at this, obviously the Bible doesn't know what it's talking about. Secondly, this tension between James and Paul left me in despair. On the question of my eternal destiny, it sure looked as if Paul and James would vote differently. Paul would look at me and say, he's got faith, he's in. James would say, his works are bad, he's out. So, at a certain point in my life, I decided to undertake a study in the book of James. I determined that I wanted to play fair. I wanted to understand James on its own terms. I was going to try to understand it without trying to compare it with what Paul was saying, but to just try to see what is the argument that James is making. And this study was one of the most important things that ever happened to me. Several things resulted. First of all, I felt that I came to understand what James meant by being justified by works. His basic point was simple, I think, ultimately. If a person actually believes something, that belief will affect the way he lives. If we claim to have faith in the gospel, and yet we never live as if the gospel were true, then our faith is questionable. James was not saying that we are justified by perfect moral obedience. He was leaving plenty of room for the grace of God, plenty of room for sinners like myself to be saved. But what he was saying is that saving faith needs to be a real faith, a faith that actually shows itself in the way we live. And since that time, I have been tracing this theme through the New Testament for over 30 years. It seems to me to be fundamental to what the New Testament authors are saying. It is fundamental to Jesus' message, to Paul's message, to all of them. The other important result that came about from this study is that this was one of many times when my confidence in the Bible increased by actually studying it. James was not contradicting Paul. They really were talking about two different issues that were compatible. And I came to find that many so-called problems disappeared when you looked carefully at what the authors were actually saying. Okay, so after 20 years of struggle and work, here is where I stood. I was deeply committed to the process of reading the biblical texts in context. This meant following the flow of thought. This meant translating from the Greek and Hebrew rather than relying on English translations. This meant reading in the light of the culture of the ancient world, not our modern culture. I also had rejected victorious Christian life theology and embraced a semi-Calvinistic theology of salvation. I was particularly interested in the relationship between what we believe and how we live. I embraced the authority and reliability of the Bible and wanted to explore other problem areas in the Bible. I had a growing confidence in the coherence of the Bible, and I wanted to search for that coherence. So this is what I wanted to do. This was what was at the core of my work and thinking. At first, I expected that I would primarily teach other Bible students. I didn't really picture myself as a teacher. Everybody knows that I'm kind of a weird guy in some ways. I'm not your typical sort of people person kind of person. It struck me that I wasn't the sort of person that ought to be a teacher. But I could imagine that I could talk to other people who wanted to be teachers. I could help them in this process of coming to understand, how do I understand the Bible better? and what tools do I need to understand the Bible better? So I wanted to be something equivalent to a seminary professor, although I wasn't really thinking of teaching in a seminary, but I wanted to teach the teachers how to profit from studying their Bibles. In the second decade of my studies, I found myself in Oregon teaching at McKenzie Study Center. And it turned out that I was teaching average lay people. I wasn't teaching the teachers, I was just teaching people. So this is what I expected to do for the rest of my life. I would be teaching Christians. In particular, I would teach those people who had been Christians long enough to have serious questions about the faith. I would be teaching people who sought me out to help them understand the Bible. I would be teaching people who were like me when I was younger, passionate to make progress in understanding the Bible. This is what I saw as my role at McKenzie Study Center. But lo and behold, in the second decade of teaching at McKenzie Study Center, we all had a fateful meeting. What was going to be the future direction of the study center? David Crabtree proposed that we start a 4-year Great Books College. And that is what we voted to do. Now, as I'm going to go on to explain here, I am a big fan of Gutenberg College, but you have to understand how this struck me at the time. I was apprehensive. And I remember standing in the parking lot after this meeting saying, I can't remember who I was talking to, actually, maybe somebody can remember and tell me, but I said at the time that I thought it would be the death of the biblical studies ministry of McKenzie Study Center. And fundamentally, I turned out to be largely correct. That's what Gutenberg swallowed up McKenzie Study Center by and large, and certainly swallowed me up. So here comes Gutenberg College. And what do I find? What sort of people were the incoming students? Were they the people I always thought I would be teaching? Were they those Christians eager to learn about the Bible from me? No, largely not. Many of the students came from Christian backgrounds that they were in the process of rejecting. I had students telling me that the Bible was toxic to them because of their background. Many of the students were pessimistic that the Bible could be understood. They were pessimistic that we could ever know the truth of things. Now, there are a lot of variety in that, but I want to reemphasize, I want to make clear right now, I love and respect all the students that have come through Gutenberg. I am not complaining in any way. I'm not saying they should have been different than they were. They're great people, and I would do anything for them, but it was just kind of a shock to me. This is not what I was expecting to do. Most of the students who came through Gutenberg looked at the Bible, looked at the world very differently than I did. And, I mean, again, I love every one of them, but let's just be clear, from where I was starting from, there have been very few students at Gutenberg who have ever come to me and asked me what I thought about the Bible. I went from a situation where people were coming specifically so they could hear me talk about the Bible. And then I went to a group of people who sometimes seemed largely unaware that I even thought about the Bible at all. So this was confusing. This was something I had to get used to. Now, it did not take long before I became a real fan of Gutenberg College. I was helped greatly in this by the fact that my own children attended Gutenberg, and I loved what happened to them through that experience. So I became a real booster, and I still am. I'm one of the great fans of Gutenberg College. But even as a fan, I still had to learn to think very differently about our role as tutors at Gutenberg. Unlike what I had always thought I was going to do, we were not really teaching students how to read the Bible. We were teaching them how to read. We were not really teaching students the truths of the Bible, at least not in any systematic way, but we were teaching them how their culture came to be skeptical about whether we can know the truth. We were teaching them that the Bible speaks to fundamental issues and could compete in the marketplace of ideas. We were providing them an opportunity to learn to discuss important ideas with other people. And we were, I hope, modeling for the students that one could take the Bible seriously without being a total creep. At any rate, this is how I came to see our role as tutors at Gutenberg, and I have loved playing that role. Okay, so now, we're finally in a position to talk about how Gutenberg College has contributed to my search to understand the Bible. Given all that background, what has happened through this process? I'm still asking the question, what does it mean to be a Christian? What does genuine spirituality look like? In one sense, teaching at Gutenberg has meant that I am spending less time studying and teaching the Bible. But two things have had a very big impact on my thinking about the faith. The first one I just described to you. I have worked with a very different set of students than I expected. And most of those students have looked at things very differently than I do. In fact, some of our students have even ended up embracing a very different Christian tradition than mine. The other thing that has had a big impact on my thinking is the fact that for a number of years I have taught several micro classes. In the micro classes, for those of you who don't know, we sit down and we work through a difficult text paragraph by paragraph. It is practice in interpretation. We're trying to learn how to understand difficult texts by paying careful attention to the context and so on. For a number of years, I have taught the micro class in the Gospel of John. And then to add to that, in the past couple of years, I have been teaching the micro class in Kierkegaard. It has been fascinating and instructive to think about my experience with this diverse set of students in the light of what I have seen in the Gospel of John and in Kierkegaard. Now, it might seem at first glance that John and Kierkegaard are 180 degrees opposed to each other. John emphasizes that salvation comes through believing the right things about Jesus. Kierkegaard emphasizes that having orthodox beliefs doesn't necessarily mean anything at all. But in fact, I believe that John and Kierkegaard are really working the same side of the street. I see the Gospel of John as exploring the nature of belief and unbelief. What we believe is ultimately a matter of the will. We see this very clearly in John. In particular, we see the interaction between Jesus and the religious leaders of the Jews exploring the issue of why didn't they respond to him? Why don't people come to Jesus, the bringer of the light? According to John, because they don't want to be exposed as wrongdoers. Why don't the Pharisees believe in Jesus? Because they want the glory that comes from other men more than they want the glory that comes from God. Why doesn't the crowd believe in Jesus when he presents himself as the bread of life? Because they want physical bread more than they want eternal life. It is not the fact of believing a certain thing that is significant. A genuine faith arises from and reflects a certain kind of heart. And it is reality of that heart that is significant, is what biblical faith ultimately is about. Throughout history, the church has tended to focus on faith as a matter of getting the right answer. The right answer is that Jesus is the Messiah, which is true, it is the right answer. But that means that people who believe that Jesus is the Messiah have the right answer, and so they're saved. The right answer is that Jesus rose from the dead. So people who believe that Jesus rose from the dead are saved. The right answer is that Jesus was born of a virgin. So people who believe in the virgin birth are saved. But the Bible says something different, I think. And in particular, John is really articulating something different. What we believe is an indication of the state of our hearts. Spiritual transformation is all about having a heart made willing to know the truth. In the Gospel of John, we see many who start out believing in Jesus, but when they realize that believing in Jesus involves things that they don't want, they abandon him. So the issue is not just having the right answer. Lots of people can have the right answer for any number of reasons. The issue is being willing to make the choice to believe. The issue is being the sort of person who is willing to change your mind in the direction of what is true. Well, this is very similar to the issue that drove Kierkegaard. In Denmark at the time, everyone would have considered themselves Christian, but Kierkegaard saw genuine faith as about decision. It's personal, subjective, passionate decision. As he said, Christianity is spirit. Spirit is inwardness. Inwardness is subjectivity. Subjectivity is essentially passion, and at its maximum, an infinite, personally interested passion for one's eternal happiness. As soon as subjectivity is taken away, and passion from subjectivity, and infinite interest from passion, there is no decision whatsoever. So, for Kierkegaard, the fact that you have orthodox beliefs is not in and of itself significant. The true issue is that you have confronted the choice whether to believe, personally, inwardly, subjectively. Now, as I said before, it might seem on the surface that John and Kierkegaard are not agreeing at all. John is emphasizing the importance of believing that Jesus is the Christ, and he really is doing that. Kierkegaard is saying that orthodox beliefs are in and of themselves insignificant. But as I read John and Kierkegaard, I think that they agree on something fundamental. Faith is only significant when it arises out of a deep, personal decision to embrace the truth. So these are the authors that I have been reading as I have been working with this diverse group of students, and it has given me a lot to think about. Let me illustrate, and in this illustration I'm going to make, I want to make it very clear that I do not have any particular students in mind. Not at all. I'm just speaking hypothetically. And this is not a joke, wink, wink, I really am. No, I am not, I have no one in mind. Because I think I could have a lot of people in mind, actually, but I just made this up. But imagine that I meet two new students that have come in. One of them comes from a fundamentalist background. She feels like the Bible was used against her in an abusive way. She, at this point, has little interest in reading the Bible, and she doesn't know whether she's a Christian or not. The other student is a committed, believing Christian who comes in telling me that he's heard every talk that I've ever given. So, at one point in my life, I would have been tempted to think of the second student as the good guy. He believes the right things. He's the one who's interested in learning about the Bible. It's that first student that has the serious problem. But now I think the situation is more complicated. After all, why would the first student want to read the Bible? All her experience with the Bible may be of people misusing it, misunderstanding it, and using it in an unloving and self-righteous way. Her suspicion of the Bible may have good support. She may be justified in being suspicious because she's never seen it used in a way that made sense. Likewise, the second student may be a committed Christian now, but ultimately, what is he all about? What does he want? He could be just like the crowds that followed Jesus, only to turn away when they found that they didn't want what he was offering. It would be foolish of me to draw some sort of conclusions about the spiritual health of these students based on this snapshot of their current state. True spirituality is an inward disposition toward the truth that makes itself known over time. This is what I have come to believe. You don't see true spirituality in a snapshot. You have to watch the whole movie. Now, at this point, I want to make something very clear. I am not at all meaning to say that it doesn't matter what we believe. I'm not saying that as long as we are sincere and have a good attitude, it doesn't matter what our religion is. That's not what John is saying. That's not what I believe. But John sees the gospel as a kind of litmus test. If you turn away from Jesus, you're turning away from God, ultimately. You are turning away from the truth. Believing in the gospel means submitting to a whole set of uncomfortable truths, like there is a God, he is good, I am not good, I need God's mercy, and so on. Ultimately, embracing the gospel of Jesus means opening our hearts to the most important truths of life. But John also makes it clear that faith can be counterfeited for a while. The real deal is an internal process that ultimately shows itself in a change of beliefs. So in my years at Gutenberg, I have learned to be cautious in thinking that I can tell where a person is on that journey. This is especially true with students who are at a time of life when everything is in flux. So here's where I find myself. I have spent over 40 years wrestling with these things, 20 of them at Gutenberg. I believe in the absolute authority and reliability of the Bible. I believe that learning to read and understand the Bible better is a skill that can be developed. I believe that the Bible has a central message that can be understood. I believe that the Bible confronts us with a life and death choice, and that each person must make that choice for themselves. And interestingly enough, I find myself teaching in a situation where many students don't know whether they agree with me about that or not. I have tremendous sympathy for their situation. Life has been a struggle for me to try to sort out and figure out what was of central importance, and I feel very sympathetic with that struggle when I see it in others. I think that there is much that is ugly and unattractive about modern church culture. It's not surprising that many students react against it. I myself react against it. But because of this, it is not surprising that many students find it difficult to sort out what they think of Christianity. I also think that modern secular culture has a huge influence on all of us that we can have a hard time recognizing. It is not surprising that students find it difficult to avoid being seduced and confused by their culture. I myself find it very difficult. But because of this, it is not surprising that students may be attracted to things that I think are bad for them. None of this is surprising. But both John and Kierkegaard agree, and they're both glad to know that I agree with them as well, that there comes a point with each individual when that person has to choose what sort of person he or she is going to be. There comes a point where we can't keep hiding behind the failings of the church culture. There comes a point where we have to stand against the current of whatever secular culture we find ourselves in. We can't keep saying, "My culture made me do it." We have to face the personal, subjective, inward choice about what sort of people we want to be. Both John and Kierkegaard agree that there comes a time when we have to stop worrying about what everyone else thinks. In the end, each of us must make the choice on our own. So, what have I learned at Gutenberg? I have grown in my belief that the journey of faith is complicated and messy. I hope I have grown in compassion and understanding for the difficulty of the journey each student must undertake. But I haven't changed my mind that in the end it is all very simple. Joshua said it thousands of years ago, "Choose this day whom you will serve." I'm done. So I was trying to leave time for some questions, and I think I've done that, so if you have anything you'd like to say or anything you'd like to ask, please do.
I'm going to try and word this well, which I may or may not succeed at, but would you say, you're talking about the heart that has to choose what's really important to it. Would you say that you believe that heart is kind of where we start? Like, that's just kind of who we are, chooses one way or another? Or would you say that we are capable of influencing that through our life, through what we do, making that heart something that can make a better choice? Because I mean, I think you probably agree that this, it's not just a one-time choice. It's
yes.
a whole process of choices. Right. So like, yeah, like what would you say to that?
I have deliberately in this talk not tried to take on the task of actually articulating my theology of salvation or sanctification or all of that. I would say several things to that. Number one, I do believe that the biblical picture is that God calls his people through this change of heart. There is a renewal through the Holy Spirit that it talks about. And what is fundamentally involved with that is moving from the place where I hate the truth about God to that place where I do not hate the truth about God, and so I am willing to learn. I am willing ultimately to believe the gospel because I am willing to see that I am not God, and I'm willing to see that I need his mercy and that sort of thing. So in that sense, I can't get back and do that for myself. But that change of heart is something that then I live out the implications of through the rest of my life. So God, we know, there's a very huge emphasis in the New Testament about what it talks about as the testing of our faith or that sort of thing. God sees the circumstances of life as something where I learn, something where I confront the truth and I have to sort out what does this mean for me personally. So the growth, that the maturity that comes in my life, in my relationship with God, is something that comes about not apart from experience, but through experience. So on the one hand, then, I would say that the Bible itself would encourage me to listen to the truth, to surround myself with things that point me in the right direction, to do things that are spiritually healthy rather than spiritually unhealthy, and so forth. So yes, all of that is part of the choice to believe, is coming to see in the world, that's not good stuff, this is good stuff, and all of that. So yes, that's a very important part of it. I do think we need to be careful. I'm aware of many, many varieties of theology out there that would like to basically say that if I make those choices, if I do the right things, if I practice the right things, if I, you know, whatever, if I pray the right stuff or I have the right disciplines or whatever, that I can actually take and channel the spiritual direction of my life in such a way that I can grab a hold of it and turn it into what it ought to be. And I think that's going too far. I don't see the biblical emphasis as being God has given me this toolkit that I can go to work on myself with. But yes, how I relate to the Bible and the people, the Christians around me and the culture that I'm in and all of that, it is in that arena where I'm going to define who I am. But ultimately, it comes back to the apostles praying things like, may God work in you that which is pleasing to him. You know, that I am counting on God to, you know, may he who began a good work in you perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus, and so on. That my living out my faith and my making those choices is ultimately a working out of a salvation that God is doing in me. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's how I'd answer.
I think so.
What church were you brought up in?
I started out in a Baptist church, but in the Bay Area, a lot of Christians in California were very influenced by a church called Peninsula Bible Church in Palo Alto. And that church influenced the church that I was in quite a bit. And then ultimately, I ended up going to Peninsula Bible Church. In fact, ultimately, in the last years I was in California, I ended up teaching there with Jack, and we both got kicked out. But that was the church that was really big on the victorious Christian life and that sort of thing. The passage that I quoted from 2 Corinthians Ray Stedman, the main teacher there at that time, he said that he thought that was like the most important passage in the Bible. So
I don't really know how to ask this, I guess. How would you got kicked out of the church in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So with your ideas that are like explicitly like, I don't know, existential or to you, mm-hmm. it's how you read the Bible, it's how you live it out. Mm-hmm. So take the idea of reading the Bible seriously, things that are anti-Christian culture. How do you exist in a vacuum? Like, I mean, would you look for a church in Christian
yeah.
culture, or would it be better to be alone on an island and try to like live out your salvation with people in bars? Like, what would you do? Like,
yeah, definitely the island. Stay away from people as much as possible.
Awesome.
Okay, so next. Okay, so I don't exactly know how to answer that. Here's my experience over the years. This is funny, but I'm deadly serious in what I'm saying. But we have had the opportunity to cause many people over the years to be kicked out of their churches. And in one way or another, we have estranged people from the community in which they grew up. That's our role in life, is to take people and make them unfit to associate with other Christians. And, okay, so, see, I
You've
mean,
done
you
a
know,
great
right,
job.
It's funny, but what I'm talking about is, like, just take the simple idea that what we want to do is we want to find out what Paul is saying in this passage. You know, I know that we have this theology, this tradition that says this, and I'm not a rebel. I'm not trying to tear the building down or anything. I'm just asking, I'm in a Bible study, and here we are together, and I observe, doesn't it seem like Paul isn't saying that thing that we're all talking about? Doesn't it seem like he's saying this over here? And what can happen in that if people aren't prepared for that? They've never experienced thinking about the Bible in that way, as strange as it might seem, is that people get very threatened. This is what happened to me. That passage in 2 Corinthians that I'm talking about, that was actually I was in a Bible study when I started thinking about this passage. Everybody in the Bible study, the leaders of the Bible study, were using this passage to teach the victorious Christian life stuff. At the time, there was a singer named John Fisher who was working at Peninsula Bible Church, and he had a whole album that he called The New Covenant that was all about exploring this theology from that passage. He had songs that were specifically dealing with that passage. So we were very into that, and in this Bible study setting, I made the observation, you know, I don't think that that's what Paul is talking about here. I think he's, look, follow this through, what he's doing here. Doesn't it look like what he's actually talking about is not our adequacy to overcome sin by plugging into the Spirit, but rather his adequacy as an apostle that God had given him, which is why they should be listening to him and respecting his apostleship. And the response I got, I've told the story many times, but it was a fundamental moment in my life, is the Bible study leader said to me, the Bible is God's love letter to me. And if that passage is talking about Paul instead of me, then it's not relevant to me. So you can't be right. It has to be about me, because if it was about Paul, then it wouldn't be relevant to me. And the Bible is relevant to me. Therefore, it can't be about Paul. Well, and this was the overwhelming response of everyone there, was like, you can't be right. That can't be true. Okay, so now multiply that by in many churches, in many situations, people who were troubled, they didn't know quite how to put things together, they heard us say a few things, and they say, you know, that makes sense. I think that makes sense of the way the Bible's looking at things. And they would raise that in their church situation, and everyone would get threatened by it. We don't want to think about those things. I mean, if that's true, then what the pastor's been saying isn't true. And we can't handle that. How can we have a church where we're saying to the pastor, what you're saying is not true? One of the things I like about the church that I'm involved with as a teacher is that it is a place where people can get up and say, I don't think that's true. That's a very important thing. But in a lot of church settings, that doesn't go down very well. But at the same time, that's not universal. I mean, sometimes you find... Okay, let me back up on this. So, now, What do other Christians mean to us? What the reality that the Bible talks about is that those who have turned to God have an affinity. We have something in common with others who have turned to God as well. They are our people. I mean, whether, you know, they may be very different than we are. You know, there may be this guy that I know is really weird, but the fact, and I, by nature, I wouldn't get along with him very well because I just find him very weird. But he actually has the same faith that I do. And that means that we have a connection that I don't have with members of my own family who are not believers. There's something there that binds us together. So those are the two, those are the points of tension, that believers in this world are my people. But it can be that if I take a stand for trying to look at the Bible and see what it's actually saying about things, that can end up being threatening, and I may have a hard time finding a community that finds me comfortable to be around. That's kind of, from my perspective, that's kind of how we ended up with the church that I'm at, which we founded, which was because nobody else would have us. I mean, basically. Of course they wanted us to come, but they wanted us to come and shut up. Yes, that's what, you know. So I think you have to continue that quest. I don't believe in that island. If you are a believer following God, trying to understand what God wants of us as he's communicated in the Bible, then there are people in the world that are your people, and I think they need to matter to you. But how to work that out, I don't know. That can get complicated.
I think you probably would agree with this. I think things haven't changed that much. The Pharisees were men devoted to knowing the truth and proclaiming it. And they tell the people, you know, we got this all figured out. And if you do this, this, and that, you'll be good with God. And Jesus came to them and he said, you guys got it all wrong. And they said, how dare you talk to us holy people like that? Right. And today the same things happen. All the churches, they got their little creeds and they say, if you believe this, you're cool. But if you say anything about any of it, man, you're a bad person.
Right. No, I 100% agree. It's always been the same thing. That we need to be careful, and when we think about, you know, we dump on the Pharisees a lot, but it's not because they were Jewish in their religion. It's not because that they followed the Old Testament. Following the Old Testament was good. Jesus followed the Old Testament. But the problem was the way you can take a perfectly good religious system and use it to justify your own self-righteousness and so on. And that can happen in Judaism, it did, and it can happen in Christianity, and it often does. I mean, in the history of the church, it has happened many, many times, and it happens today. Let me just be careful that I don't communicate the wrong thing. I am not down on churches. Every church I've ever been in, I have met people that seem to me that have the same faith that I do. But as a cultural phenomenon, we are just aware that there's good and bad out there in what we see in the church world. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, because otherwise, what do we have to say to the person who's in the middle of that situation and confused by it and thinks, this is Christianity, I don't want anything to do with it? I mean, we have to be willing to say, well, let's at least look this over and see if maybe there isn't another problem here. Go ahead.
I have kind of a segue question to what you just said.
Okay.
Well, what if I am confused? What if I really don't know all this? What if I all of a sudden find myself surrounded by all these Bible people, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure about Jesus, I don't know about mm-hmm. really about God, I don't know what next thing to do. What do I do, Ron?
Well, okay, I have an answer to that, and it's going to sound really pious. So you just have to forgive me. But basically, this is a thing that I am working out with God, and God is taking the lead. So my simple answer to that question is that I cry out to God. What the heck is going on? I don't get it. And the reason I say that is that's what I did. I mean, maybe I don't mean to see that as a model, but I spent several years of my life going, I don't get it. I do not get this. But I believed that there was a God there who that I could address that to, and that something would emerge from that. I've often told this story, but it was a very significant thing in my life. At a certain point, after several years of struggling and trying to sort things out, I went to a friend's house. He lived on the coast, and while he was at work, I spent the day, you know, it's very romantic, walking on the beach, thinking about my life and my faith and everything. And at the end of that weekend, I sat down with a piece of paper and I wrote three questions. These were my questions to God. This was my, God, here, this is it. This is what I'm trying to do. And the first question was, what is the Bible and what am I supposed to do with it? And the second question was, kind of, how should we then live? I mean, what does it mean then? What do I do? What does it want me to do? What do you want me to do? And then the third question was the personal question, because I was a young man struggling with the issue of what am I going to do with my life? So the third question is, what am I going to do with my life? And then I took that paper and I stuck it away someplace and I forgot all about it. And a number of years later, I went and I found that piece of paper and I pulled it out and I realized that in the years since I had wrote that God had answered all three questions. So that's my answer is, God knows how to get you there, so just don't give up on him, would be my answer. And then try to find people, be on the lookout for people who seem to be thoughtful about this stuff and who might have something helpful to say. Don't get sucked in, don't let anybody become God to you, but just be on the lookout for things that might help.
Hey, Ron, could you talk for a minute about the future of, I know David's going to address the future of Gutenberg, and I don't know, for the next 20 years or just in the near future, but with the way culture is shifting, it seems to me it's just shifting faster and faster.
Yeah.
Do you think it's going to get tougher, do you think there's going to be more of an appetite for what Gutenberg offers than there is now in light of the shifting culture?
I think this phrase comes from the Bible. I am not a prophet or the son of a prophet. I could believe both things. I could convince myself either way. By temperament, I am a pessimist. So I tend to think that it's all going to go downhill and there'll be less and less interest in it. But I don't know. The thing is that the more that culture unravels, the more potential there is for people to recognize, you know, whatever I have sort of imbibed and bought into here is not doing it somehow. It's not, there's something missing. And that has the potential to be a catalyst for people recognizing that maybe what I'm looking for doesn't look like what I thought it did. So I could believe that could happen. I would like to believe that would happen. Gutenberg, I mean, everybody here knows this. Gutenberg is a hard sell and an acquired taste. Most of the students who have come through here go through that initial period where they're trying to sort out, do I want this? Now that I've kind of figured out what this thing is, I didn't realize exactly what it was I was getting involved in, do I want this? And the ones who make it to the end are the ones who look at this and go, yeah, now that I see it, this I do want it. This is what I want to do. So it's hard, and it's getting harder. In an environment where it's harder to find jobs, it's harder to convince people that you want to take some time that is not immediately focused on preparing you to get a good job. I understand that. We try to tell people that, you know, the kind of education that you get at Gutenberg is not as irrelevant to your economic future as you might think, that it actually, there's a lot that you get from this that is very valuable to employers, that they might discover that you're the sort of person that they want, even though you don't have the particular sort of training that they're looking for. That has happened to some of our students who have gotten jobs over people that were more qualified than they were because they were the sort of person that they were looking for. But, yeah, I don't know. We've always had a hard time finding the students that would be interested in what we're doing. I would like to think, I would love it if that logjam would sort of break and we would find that surely in a world with this many people in it, there must be enough people interested in this kind of education to populate this little school. So I would like to think that could happen, but I could give you my pessimistic talk, but I'll leave that out. You can imagine what that is like. Okay, thanks.